This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jessica Williams, became the youngest Daily Show correspondent ever back in 2012 when she was 22 years old and still in college. She became famous for her hilarious reports on racism, sexism, and homophobia. She gives more personal takes on gender and race as the co-host of the comedy podcast Two Dope Queens. Now she's starring in a new Netflix movie, a romantic comedy called The Incredible Jessica James. It will be on Netflix starting Friday. She plays an aspiring playwright who has nothing to show for her work except a wall full of rejection notices. And she's still getting over a bad breakup with her boyfriend. After striking out on Tinder, her best friend sets her up with a guy named Boone, who's still getting over his divorce. Here's the scene at a restaurant where Boone and Jessica first meet. Boone is played by Chris O'Dowd.
So, Tasha tells me you're a playwright.
Yeah, I write plays. That's something that I do.
Have you written anything I might have seen?
Do you see a lot of plays?
Did you write Hamilton?
Have you seen Hamilton?
No.
No, I didn't write Hamilton. I haven't had a play produced in New York.
Oh.
I have had interest from a small handful of theater companies, though, and they want to work with me, so I'm just waiting, right place, right time, so I can make my mark.
I don't know anything about theater.
It's pretty much all I care about.
Well, that's great that you're committed to something you love.
Why'd you get divorced?
That's a pretty brutal transition, don't you think?
No offense, but I don't even know if I want to be here right now.
Oh, well, why would I be offended by that?
I don't know, Tasha thought this would be good for me to help me get over this guy I thought I was in love with, but to be honest, this whole thing is making me think of him more intensely.
Oh yeah? How so?
I'm just really reminded of how much of him you're not.
Cool. I mean, I get it. You are the complete opposite to my ex-wife.
What is she, dumb, short, and fugly?
What I meant was, compared to her, you are much more forthright.
Jessica Williams, welcome to Fresh Air. What did you most relate to about the character you're playing in this movie? Were there parts of the story or parts of her personality that you wrote in? Because the role was written for you, so I imagine you had a chance to give some input.
Yes, I was pretty involved with the development of the character and the story from concept to creation. I really wanted to make sure that Jessica James felt sort of very now and authentic to me and the women that I have in my life. And I eventually became executive producer of the movie just because I got to have a lot of creative input. But Jim Strauss, who wrote and directed this movie, gave me a lot of room to improvise and ad lib, and especially since I come from a comedy background. And that was really helpful in making me feel comfortable.
So your character is a playwright and is constantly getting rejection letters, which she has displayed on her wall at home. It's kind of like rejection letter wallpaper. She's gotten so many of them. That's a phase you never had to go through when you were starting your career, because you got on The Daily Show when you were 22. You got the job when you were still taking your finals in the final semester at Cal State. So how did you get to even audition for the show?
Okay, Terry. I've always wanted to call you that. Terry.
Yes.
I'm going to stop you right there, Terry.
I love hearing you say that.
Good. Okay, good. But Terry, I got to say, I am a 6 foot tall black woman, and I have been since I was about 13 years old. So as a comedian and improviser and somebody who did a lot of sketch and was an actress, I got tons of rejection early on. I just got so many no's. I started acting when I was maybe 10 years old, and I grew up in LA, so it was a lot easier there. But right before I got The Daily Show, I would get kind of close to a lot of things. But I remember I went to one audition for a sketch show, and one of the guys looked at me, and he was white, and he was like, "You know what? I can see that you're good and you're really raw, but I just don't know what to do with you." And then I remember getting really close for another sketch project that was actually all black, like traditionally a very black comedy project. And I just remember going in the room and doing the bits that I was doing and not really getting any response whatsoever. And it really, like, was a lot of no's. And then I was auditioning for something else. I was in Upright Citizens Brigade. And I was auditioning for a movie. And the casting director, her name's Allison Jones, and she's amazing. But at the audition, she was like, okay, you might not be right for it, but I know that they're casting The Daily Show in New York. They're looking for contributors. Why don't you come back and you submit a tape? And in my head, I was like, thank you. But also in the back of my head, I was like, wait, did I just not get this part right now? Cool. And I knew a lot about The Daily Show. I was a fan. I knew that The Daily Show was that show that my professors played in class when they didn't feel like teaching that day.
That's how you thought of it?
Yeah. They'd be like, I was busy. Why don't you guys watch this thing on satire? And it'd be a piece from John Oliver or something. And I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? There are other correspondents there. I know that. I know that about Colbert and Samantha Bee and Wyatt Cenac. But what I want to do is, okay, I'm 22 years old. I'm Black. I'm a female. I have so much emotion that I carry around simply from being Black and a woman. I want to be the most myself that I could possibly be. So I actively didn't Google any of the other correspondents to watch their work. I really just tried to make sure that no matter what, when I walked back into that audition, that I was just myself.
What was the audition piece you were given?
There were two. There was one that was a stand-up piece in front of a green screen that we normally do in the studio where we're reporting live from somewhere that we're obviously not at. And then the other one was a sit-down chat at the desk. And I think one was Asif Manvi's and the other one was John Oliver's. And they were pretty...
So you were doing pieces that had already been done?
Yes. But they were...
And you made sure not to watch the original versions?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And they were sort of dummy sides in the way, like it didn't have Asif's spin on it or Oliver's spin on it. Their standalone were just great pieces. And so I remember being super excited when I was at the cafeteria at my college to meet my best friend. We would always meet at Panda Express at Cal State Long Beach in the cafeteria before class. And I got a call from my manager who was like, hold on to your butt. Jon Stewart wants to fly you out to audition with him in the studio in New York City as soon as possible. And my best friend and I just started screaming. And then I rushed home and I told my mom, I was like, Mom, I have an audition to go into the studio with Jon Stewart. And my mom was like, that's right. That's my baby. That's right. And I was like, great. I need to go to the mall and I need to get a suit. My mom was like, that's right. I was like, great. So can you take me to J. Crew? And she was like, we ain't got J. Crew money. We going to TJ Maxx. So I was pissed off because my mom is a Maxinista. And so I was trying to be fly. She was trying to be frugal. So I flew in. It was around the time that Nicki Minaj's Pink Friday album came out. And she has a really great song on there that's really good for getting pumped. And she's like, raw, like a dungeon dragon. So I was just like listening to that just nonstop. I was so confident. And then as soon as I got to the studio, they were like, okay, we're going to take you into the studio. I met some producers. You run it a few times and then we'll bring John down. And he walks up to me and he shakes my hand and he's like, hey, Jessica, I'm John. And I'm like, hi, I'm Jessica. Nice to meet you. And he's like, here's what you need to know. I already saw your tape. I already think you're really funny. The only thing that you have to worry about is just being present with me. That's all I want is for you to be present with me. And that was really nice of him because I had been on job interviews at the mall at certain places and they'd be like, we take folding shirts very seriously here. Don't come here with nonsense, you know? And just for this guy to just release me and just be like, hey, just be yourself. It's fine. Was really, really liberating. So we did the audition and we're flowing and I'm improvising here and there and he's giving me notes and I'm taking the notes and it just felt like a really, really good Tinder date. And I was like, cool, he's definitely going to call. And then I went back to L.A. And then I kid you not, I was at that same cafeteria at Panda Express when I got the call again that said that they were not going to hire me as a contributor, but they were going to hire me as a correspondent to be a part of the best news team during an election year. So I was so excited.
That's so great. Okay, so let's hear an example of you on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And this was from June of 2015. And this was after that incident in Texas, like the pool party incident where a white cop came in or a few white cops and because they'd gotten a call about a pool party, and they started, you know, harassing the black teenagers who were at this party. And one of the officers slammed to the ground a 15-year-old girl who was wearing a bikini. So here you are with John Stewart talking about that in June of 2015.
We go to our senior Texas aquatics correspondent, Jessica Williams. She's in McKinney tonight. Thank you for joining us, Jessica.
Oh, yeah, it's no problem, John. I'm just going to another pool party.
In what appear, that looks like full body armor. Though.
Yep, that's right. Or as they call it here, a McKinney bikini.
A McKinney.
Oh, John, I like that.
Thank you.
This week's incident has taught black people here something valuable. Yeah. It's that when you go to a pool party, even in your own neighborhood that you live in, you have to know pool etiquette, which is no running, no splashing, no talking back, and if at all possible, get your ass even further into the ground than it is.
But this, you know, it's, this was a pool party.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be fun, you know, the water balloons and super soakers.
A water gun at a Texas pool party? Are you trying to get me killed?
No, it's Texas. People are always waving guns around.
No, white people are, and they call it open carry. For black people, it's called, he's got a gun, he's got a gun, he's got a gun!
Jessica, are these things happening more and more, or are we just seeing it more and more because of the prevalence of camera phones?
I don't know, but either way, this incident is progress. What?
Jessica, a cop pulled his gun out and dragged a 14-year-old girl to the ground by her hair.
Yeah, I know. White people always want to touch our hair. It's nothing new.
Okay, so that's my guest, Jessica Williams, with Jon Stewart in 2015. When you joined The Daily Show, you were 22. You were the youngest Daily Show correspondent in its history. And so here you are walking in at the age of 22 to this really, at this point, established, really important show. Did you try to compensate for the fact that you were so young and kind of inexperienced compared to the other people on the show?
I did. I think when I first started the show, I was really, really worried about what other people thought and what other people thought of me. I remember when I did my first piece, my Twitter blew up, and most of the things that I got were, you know, the N-word, Uncle Tom, you know, coon, like all of these different mean things that I wasn't prepared for at 22. And I think a lot of that stuff got into my head where I was like, oh man, should I like be here? Like, this is a really important show to a lot of people. And Samantha Bee is amazing. And John Oliver is really great. And I really sort of got in my head about it. And I think once I did more therapy and started to think more about what it was that I cared about, that I really started to care less about what other people thought of me and the mean things that people could say about me. And I think once I figured out what my beat was, and I think in general what I cared about were women's issues, issues for people of color, and LGBT issues. And so once I did that, then I felt a lot more confident about what I was doing, because the responses that I was getting from the people that I was trying to talk about in the stories that I was covering, it was a lot more significant. And I felt like, oh, I have support here.
So you've said about yourself that you don't like confrontations. But you were in the position where you were kind of getting in people's faces. And so you would do, reports in which you were at an anti-gay marriage rally right before the Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage. And so, like, you'd go up to the person who had, like, the meanest reputation and start asking him questions. And he would just be like, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I hate gay people, you know?
Ruthless. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, just ruthless.
So what did it take for you personally to put yourself in that kind of position if you don't like confrontation and you know that these people can be very confrontational? Of course, you have the protection of a camera and a camera crew and probably a producer with you. So you're unlikely to be attacked or anything, but what did you have to do to get yourself in a psychological space to be comfortable with that?
That's such a great question. You're so good at questions. Like, you're so good. Okay.
I keep going.
Feel
yes.
You're great at questions. You're a legende. That was the hardest part of the job, actually, for me, was doing field pieces where I would just be out interviewing people that oftentimes were very hateful. I really had to psych myself up to do it. And I remember, like, my first few pieces, like, calling other correspondents to be like, I'm really nervous to go into this panel of really, 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 really right-wing people. Like, I would be really afraid. And that piece that you're talking about where I was at the anti-gay marriage rally, I was particularly afraid that day just because I had never seen anything like that. The climate was so horrible. Like, it was just very, very intense. And I think I would just really try and psych myself up and try and I would just be like, okay, if you can just do this bit for, okay, 5 minutes. If you can just be a little bit braver for 5 minutes, you just knock this bit out and then you can go home. You'll get room service when you go back to your room. Just knock this bit out. You're going to be embarrassed for a little bit. He might call you names, but it doesn't mean anything. Just be a little bit braver. You got this. You got this. You got this. You got this.
So on Two Dope Queens, you and Phoebe talk a lot about sex. Now, you grew up with Christian parents. I read that you had a church purity ceremony at age 14, which I think commits you to virginity until marriage, chastity until marriage. Is that right?
I did. It's deeply upsetting. This is like deep cut. We had these crazy white gowns, and I remember our pastor putting rings on our fingers, and we were all women, and the whole church was there pretty much. And I remember that being the first time where I felt like my body wasn't my own. And as a woman, my body, no matter what I did with it, it belonged to somebody else. And I was responsible for guarding this idea of purity. And if I didn't, then there was something wrong with me. And so I think, in a way, Two Dope Queens has really helped me because we really talk about sex.
You really do.
And there is, we do, like, we get down and dirty.
So when you were growing up in a Christian family and you had the purity ceremony, mm-hmm. was most of your world a part of that world? Or did you have a world of friends who are outside of that Christian world and were having sex when they were teenagers and doing other things that you were perhaps prohibited from doing?
It was very split. I always felt like my church that I went to was very Black. And when I was young, I had to go to a magnet school because I had tested out of my elementary school. So when I transferred over to that school, I was in a world that was predominantly white and Korean. And so I was in a different suburban world where everybody listened to Blink 182 and like Sum 41 and everybody wore like Heelys and stuff. And then I cut to once a week, I would be going with my parents to my very, very Black church. And I felt very disconnected from both. And I mean Black church in the sense, I should clarify that. I mean, it was very traditionally Baptist for a long time. And so I really always felt like, when I was at church, I always felt sort of disconnected from my community in that sense. And then when I was at school and I was hanging out with all the like blonde white students, I also felt very disconnected from them as well.
At what point did you kind of leave the Christian community?
Maybe when I was about 14. Mm-hmm. I remember it was an Easter ceremony and we had really crazy Easter ceremonies. And this particular year, the dance ministry, the praise ministry, and the like audiovisual ministry had all come together to do this really elaborate retelling of the story of the crucifixion of Jesus. And this time they had gotten live animals. And so it was insane because donkeys were like taking dumps everywhere, and there were like doves flying around. And we had this guy, sexy Black Jesus, who like Eric Benet was very in vogue at the time, so he had these really beautiful dreads, and he walked around in this like long cloth, and you can just tell he just knew that he was like hot, you know? And everybody at church is like they're so moved and they're so emotional about this retelling. And then finally, after he went on trial, spoiler alert, the character of Jesus goes on trial. After he goes on trial, they're like, crucify him. And so then I remember all the lights blacked out, and then they cut to a clip from The Passion of the Christ. And I don't know when
the Mel Gibson
it was
movie?
The last. Yeah, the Mel Gibson vehicle. And I don't know when's the last time you saw that movie, but we had like sexy black Jesus, and then they cut to really white Jim Caviezel Jesus. And I'm not saying that Jesus was like definitely super black, but I think he's at least some sort of brown, like a vague brown, like a latte brown. You know what I mean? And then finally, they strapped sexy black Jesus into a harness, and then he lifted up into the rafters, and everyone was just crying and was so moved. And I just remember feeling completely disconnected from that performance. And I just remember being like, okay, I don't know if this is my scene exactly.
So since your new movie, The Incredible Jessica James, is a romantic comedy, and it's about, in part, about how you meet people, can I ask you how you met your boyfriend?
Yeah, I was inside playing The Sims because that's like my favorite game ever. And I think I was like 2 years in The Daily Show, so I was like spending a lot of my time just playing The Sims and watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I was like, you know what? I got to get outside. It's Saturday. And so I walked outside, and this guy is like, oh my gosh, I love you. And then I look, and it's this tall, beautiful man. And he's like, I'm so sorry. I'm on my way to a music festival. I've had a couple of drinks, but I think you are so funny and talented. I love you on The Daily Show. And so we took a photo or whatever. And then I was like, I hope he tags me on something. And then he didn't tag me. Cut to like 10 days later. Girl, it's like two for $10 mimosas somewhere in Williamsburg. So obviously, Ter-Ter, I had maybe seven mimosas. And I walk into this bar, and then somebody taps me on the shoulder, and I turn around, and it's the same guy. And I was like, oh my gosh, hi. And so then we like started talking. And then he asked me out, and then we like went out on some dates, and he was like really good at dates. It was really fun.
So let me ask you, because we talked about this a little in the beginning of the interview. Does the fact that you're black and he's white come up a lot in the relationship? And in other words, like, is that an issue you talk about a lot when you're talking about your past or your present?
We do. Yeah, we do. I think if you're like in an interrelash, it's like different for everybody. But I know for us, we are constantly circling back to me not mistaking him for all white people, which I can do sometimes when I'm super worked up, and then him just like listening to what my grievances are and then allowing it to be something that he cannot fix.
Right.
Does also, he's going to be very jazzed that I'm talking about him on this episode.
Jessica Williams, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm very excited.
Jessica Williams stars in the new Netflix movie, The Incredible Jessica James. This is Fresh Air Weekend. When Chester Himes published his first novel in the 1940s, he was hailed as a worthy member of an elite company of black intellectuals and writers, like Ralph Ellison and Richard Wright. But these days, Himes' literary legacy is largely forgotten. A new biography of Himes, by scholar Lawrence P. Jackson, aims to make Himes' work and incredible life better known. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Most readers these days who know Chester Himes know him for his detective fiction. Novels like The Real Cool Killers and Cotton Comes to Harlem, which were written late in his career, during the 1950s and 60s. These hard-boiled stories, featuring black New York City police detectives Gravedigger Jones and Coffin Ed Johnson, are brutal and wildly surreal. But no more brutal and surreal, Himes may have said, than the situation of being black, even of being a prominent black writer, in mid-20th century America. Lawrence P. Jackson's meticulous big new biography of Himes, called simply Chester B. Himes, makes a convincing case for a writer who's always been something of a tough sell. Himes's early literary novels, like his debut If He Hollers, Let Him Go, were dismissed as second-rate social problem literature by the young James Baldwin. Of his second novel, The Lonely Crusade, the reviewer in the Atlantic Monthly complained, "Hatred reeks through his pages like yellow bile." But implicit in that pan lurks a compliment that was almost always paid to Himes, that the harshness of his writing gave it a unique power. Himes, as a biographical subject, is also something of a tough sell. He always seems to have been spoiling for a fight, alienating family and making enemies of both his white supporters and his black literary mentors and colleagues like Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, and Ralph Ellison. As Jackson says, Himes specialized in biting the hand that fed him. But Jackson also argues that it's worth hanging in there with Himes, not only because he produced some of the most original novels we have in the American canon, but also because his own life story is just as wild as anything he ever dreamt up. Himes was born in 1909 in Jefferson City, Missouri. His father was a college professor who taught industrial arts. Indeed, one of the many bonuses of this biography is its vivid excursion into the world of black colleges in the South and Midwest, where Himes's father taught. Himes's mother was also college educated. A light-skinned woman, she was also, as Jackson says, color-struck, and tried to build her sons up by telling them they mustn't think of themselves as colored because they had fine white blood in their veins. In his novels, Himes would later lash out at the pretensions and black-on-black racism of middle-class African-Americans like his mother. Though his brothers went on to solid careers, Himes rebelled against the message of uplift that he received at home and school. While an undergrad at Ohio State University, Himes sought out a rougher kind of education in the gambling dens, speakeasies, and bordellos around campus. He was arrested for using fake ID and cashing a bad check. Out on bail, Himes stole a car, drove to a white neighborhood, and, armed with a handgun, forced his way into a wealthy home and robbed the couple inside. He was caught the next day. The upshot was the stuff of nightmares. 19-year-old Chester Himes went from the state university to the state penitentiary. He was given the maximum sentence of 20 years, although he would serve only 7 of those hard years. As interesting as Jackson's account of Himes's later life is, including his eventual self-exile in Paris, a deep friendship with Malcolm X, and the turn to writing the detective novels that would bring him fame and financial success, it's the long section of this biography about Himes's prison years that's most absorbing. Himes started writing in his cement cell block on a typewriter he bought partly with gambling winnings. He was encouraged by a fellow prisoner with literary aspirations with whom he had a sexual relationship, a relationship Himes would later fictionalize and not hide from his two wives. The prison stories Himes wrote eventually found a home in Esquire, alongside short stories by Hemingway. Himes, like the literature he created, was difficult and sometimes cruel, but Jackson insists he's worth the trouble. At the end of this biography, Jackson memorably characterizes Himes's great gifts as a writer, describing Himes's spirited realism from the bottom that defied fear and always cut hard enough to draw blood. That sentence, and many more like it, make me intrigued enough to want to read Himes's work beyond the detective novels I already know.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the new biography, Chester B. Himes, by Lawrence P. Jackson. Coming up, New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker talks about some of the unprecedented actions and comments coming out of the Trump White House. We're going to take a look back at some of President Trump's unprecedented comments and actions with Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. He was one of the 3 Times reporters who had a joint on-the-record interview with Trump earlier this month. And of course, Baker's work is affected by the recent shakeup in Trump's communications staff. The president appointed Anthony Scaramucci as the new White House communications director, Press Secretary Sean Spicer resigned. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was promoted to press secretary. Peter Baker brings a unique perspective to covering the Trump White House because he also covered the presidencies of Bill Clinton, including his impeachment, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. Baker has written books about each of them. His new book, Obama, The Call of History, is illustrated with photos from the Times. Baker spent 20 years at the Washington Post, including 4 years, 2000 to 2004, as Moscow bureau chief, a position he shared with his wife, Susan Glasser. Our interview was recorded Wednesday. Peter Baker, welcome to Fresh Air. So there's been a big shakeup in the White House communications office. The new White House communications director is Anthony Scaramucci. His background is in finance. He worked at Goldman Sachs. He ran a hedge fund. So what does the shakeup mean for you as chief White House correspondent?
Well, you know, I think that after 6 months, the environment with Sean Spicer had grown so toxic, so poisonous, so hostile that it was unproductive for everybody. It wasn't productive for the White House. They weren't getting their message out. They were just engaging in you know, verbal fisticuffs with reporters. And the reporters weren't getting information or getting, you know, useful briefings. So this is a chance to, you know, I think Scaramucci the other day called it, you know, clear the fog and clear the smog and basically have a reset, if you will. And so we hope that that will happen, that we can have a productive and professional, even though it's an adversarial relationship. We're not on the same team. And so there's normal for a White House and a press corps to be at odds. But there are ways of doing it that are professional and civil and not degenerating into the kind of back and forth that we've seen these last 6 months. We'll see if that changes. But I think it's also not entirely due to Sean Spicer. It is sort of a modus vivendi of this White House. And I think that they see a political benefit to having the media as an enemy. And again, it's our job not to be an enemy, but to be an independent force in democracy that we were intended to be. I know that sounds kind of, you know, hokey or highfalutin, but you know, we take that seriously. We really think that we have an important role to play in society.
Do you go to the White House press briefings?
Yeah, sure. We take turns. There are six of us who cover the White House for the New York Times. I have a great team, and we take turns. We have a duty week schedule, and when it's my duty week, I go to the briefings like everybody else. Yeah.
Do you ever feel, what's the point? I mean, there's been so little information actually coming out at the press briefings.
Yeah. Look, I've been going to press briefings now at the White House for 21 years. I started in 1996 when Bill Clinton was in his first term. And it has progressively gotten less useful as an institution over that time. That's not due just to Donald Trump. That's been true, you know, from Clinton to Bush to Obama to Trump. And that's partly because I think press secretaries have grown, you know, nervous about, you know, the gotcha game. And we play that, too. We have a role in that, I think, to acknowledge. With the advent of social media and the internet and, you know, the sort of intense accelerated news cycle, any single thing a press secretary says can be instant and huge news, over the top news, in fact, sometimes way over interpreted. So they've grown cautious and scripted and controlled and therefore less, you know, candid and less useful. Having said that, some people say, well, let's get rid of the briefing then, they're no good. But I think it's a bad idea. As much as the briefing is a flawed, you know, institution right now, we ought to mend it, not end it, as Bill Clinton used to say about affirmative action. And I think that, you know, I think of the briefing kind of like Winston Churchill said about democracy. It's the worst form of government, except for all the others, right? You know, the briefing is still as tendentious as it is, as useless as it can be on some days. It's still the one opportunity in our democracy where the most powerful person in the world is forced through a spokesperson to respond, or at least not respond if they choose to questions that they may not want to answer. And if we didn't have a briefing, it's on the record. If we didn't have a briefing, then, and we all just called individually, then they would be calling back and putting everything on background, no names or not answering or refusing to respond. And I just think that's terrible. I think that there's a place in our society where the White House has to respond or at least address the fact that they're not responding to questions of importance to the public.
So you were one of the three New York Times reporters who interviewed Donald Trump last week. It was you, Maggie Haberman, and Michael Schmidt. How did the three of you prepare together and separately for this interview?
Well, we came up with a list of questions. We weren't 100% sure he would decide to talk to us on the record when we went in. And as soon as we asked, he said, sure, of course, which we anticipated. And so we collaborated and came up with a list of probably 30, 40, 50 questions, none of, you know, only a small fraction of which we could get to. And the exercise of coming up with questions is important because you want to be able to maximize whatever time you get for an interview with a president. It's so different with each president, but this one in particular, you want to be able to try to pin down as much as you can. He tends to veer wildly from topic to topic, and sort of returning him to the central question is a bit of a challenge. The flip side is he doesn't mind if you interrupt him, unlike, say, President Obama, who very much did mind if you interrupted him. And so, you know, controlling the conversation, making sure you get as many of the questions you want to get in as possible, making sure the questions are worded in a way that is designed to get a president off his talking points and to say something new or candid or fresh, that's the real challenge. And so the idea of managing that interview to maximize what time you do have is central to what you're doing there.
You mentioned the importance of follow-ups, and something you just kept returning to no matter where the president strayed was the subject of the email to Don Jr., the email about the meeting with the Russian lawyer and other Russians. Remind us who was at the meeting.
Right. Well, Don Jr. Organized the meeting along with a contact of his, Rob Goldstone, who was a British publicist. And Don Jr. invited Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort to join him. Paul Manafort was the campaign chairman at the time. On the other side was Natalia Veselnitskaya, who was a lawyer who has ties to the power structure in Russia. And she brought along a couple others as well. And the email to Don Jr. setting this up from Rod Goldstone specifically said that she was a Russian government attorney. Now, she doesn't actually work for the government, but the email to Don Jr. said that she did. So that's what he understood. And it said that the information that he had that would be incriminating to Hillary Clinton was part of the Russia government support for Mr. Trump's campaign. And that phrase struck me as something that really deserved a lot more follow-up. And I asked him about that. I said, well, what does that phrase tell you? And he says, well, I didn't know about the meeting at the time. I said, okay, but you now know about this phrase. You know that this email said that the Russian government supported you and that this idea of incriminating information for Hillary Clinton was coming, in effect, from the Russian government. How do you feel about that? How do you respond to that? Does that cause you any concern? And he drifted away from the question a couple of times. So I think I came back at it probably three times. And eventually his answer was, well, look, I already had so much damaging information, so much negative things to say about Hillary Clinton that I didn't need the Russians or anybody else to give me any more. I think his quote was, you know, unless she shot somebody in the back, I didn't need anything more to add to my repertoire. That, of course, didn't really even answer the question. It didn't say whether he found it concerning that the Russian government would be supporting him. But it was an interesting answer. And at some point, you end up having to move on because there are so many other questions to ask.
So the impression I got from hearing parts of the interview, reading the transcript, and hearing you talk about it is that when you're interviewing Donald Trump, he drifts a lot. And you have to keep getting him back to the question that you're asking him, to the subject that you're trying to get to the heart of. Can you follow his train of thought when he drifts?
Yeah, but it meanders to different subjects, and the problem is the challenge is that, you know, you're asking this question, you want to get an answer to this question, and he starts to answer, but then he kind of heads off in a different direction. And you would normally, if that happens, you would want to pull an interview subject back to the first question. But the problem is wherever he drifts off to sometimes could be news too, and you're like, well, wait a second, I need to ask about that as well. Well, he just said something extraordinary, right? So you ask about the email, and suddenly he's saying he regrets hiring appointing his attorney general. Well, you can't let that go, even though you want to go back to the first question. So as he sort of, you know, drifts along or wanders along a different subject, each of them seems to be in some ways newsy and interesting and worth following up. And the problem as an interviewer is to figure out which of these things you need to actually zero in on and focus on, because you're not going to be able to get to all of them.
You know, the Republican Party used to be so anti-Soviet, so anti-communist. And now it seems to be members of the Republican Party, not all members, but some members, including President Trump and many people in his administration, who seem to be more sympathetic to Russia and who have financial ties or former, you know, political advisory ties to Russia. Do you have any explanation of what changed, of how it changed?
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? It is surprising because really the sine qua non of the Republican Party for decades was its skepticism, if not outright hostility, to Russia under its various forms. And that was the thing that pulled people together. Like, the Republican Party was a, you know, disparate coalition of social conservatives who cared more about family values and libertarians who cared more about the size of government and national security hawks. And the one thing that really pulled them all together was this idea that Russia was the bad guy, the enemy. And to see the current Republican president take the opposite view, not just that Russia can be a partner, but that Russia is actually, you know, something to be praised, that Vladimir Putin is a stronger leader than our former president, Barack Obama, as President Trump has said, that in fact, when somebody says, well, Putin is a killer, he says, well, aren't we all? It's stunning. It's a stunning turnaround. And I think it makes a lot of Republicans very uncomfortable. If you look at Capitol Hill, they're not buying into this. I mean, they have not suddenly become Russophiles in the Republican Party on the House and Senate. Just this week, they have now put together legislation to basically take away President Trump's flexibility when it comes to sanctions on Russia. They passed legislation in the House that has already, different versions already passed the Senate, that says the president can't lift sanctions on his own without Congress having a chance to undo it. That's because they don't, in fact, haven't changed their mind about Russia, and they don't trust President Trump and his affinity for President Putin.
Do you have any indication about whether President Trump will sign that legislation?
I think he will. He doesn't really have any choice. It passed the Senate 97-2, and it passed the House with more than 400 votes, so they would override a veto. They haven't reconciled the two versions of the bill yet. It still has to finish up the process before it goes to him. But the White House basically has no choice. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the new press secretary, indicated the other day that they were supportive of the compromise bill that came out, and they claimed that it had been made better from their point of view. And while they didn't say flatly that he would sign it, you know, all indications are that he basically will, because to be overridden on a veto on this would be politically disastrous.
Peter Baker is the New York Times chief White House correspondent. Our interview was recorded Wednesday. On Thursday, before we broadcast the interview, we called him to talk about the story he co-wrote that was published that day on the front page about Republican opposition to Trump's public campaign against his attorney general, Jeff Sessions. So President Trump has made it clear he thinks Jeff Sessions shouldn't have recused himself in the Trump-Russia investigations. And the president has basically invited Jeff Sessions to resign and has seemed to be on the verge of firing him. What did you report today about how Republican senators are trying to oppose that?
Well, what President Trump has done here, he's touched off a real revolt among his own colleagues, his own party members in the Senate. These guys served with Jeff Sessions. They consider him a friend. They went through a brutal confirmation process with him. And they're upset at this idea that he would be whipped around like this, much less forced out. And they have basically told the White House, no way. We're not confirming another AG just because you want to push this guy out. In fact, Chuck Grassley, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, tweeted overnight that his schedule is full. He has no room for more confirmations. He wrote no AG. And I think that's just a sign of how upset they are about this. This has crossed a red line for them.
Okay, but one scenario is that the president fires Jeff Sessions and makes an interim appointment of an attorney general, which doesn't require Senate confirmation. And then the new attorney general fires special counsel Robert Mueller. What are you hearing about that now?
Sorry. So here's the thing. Yeah, so if the Senate Republicans are so upset, they basically told the White House that they will block a recess appointment by refusing to go out of session completely. They'll have what they call pro forma sessions. They'll have a senator go into the chamber once every 3 days, gavel, you know, hit the gavel, and that will count as a session. So the president can't use his recess appointment powers. That's the first time a Senate will have done that to a president of their own party. Usually they do that to presidents of the other party. So they're really very serious about this, and I think that's one of the reasons why it looks like the president might be kind of beginning to back off a little bit.
You report that there are members of the White House staff who are also opposing firing Jeff Sessions. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, I think almost all of them. I mean, most of them are anyway. A couple, you know, first of all, some of Jeff Sessions' own top aides work, former aides work at the White House in key positions. And you have an alliance here of Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, and Steve Bannon, the chief strategist, and Don McGahn, the White House counsel, all of whom have told the president this is not a good idea. Let's cool this off a little bit. You know, and they believe the moment anyway, we're told by people who talk to them that that storm might have begun to pass. That doesn't mean the president won't still criticize Sessions, but that the danger of him being fired may be passing. Now, nobody knows with President Trump. That's the one thing we've learned, is anything can happen at any time. But they hope that they've gotten through to him that firing Jeff Sessions would be a dangerous thing, because even the conservatives who have supported President Trump don't want him to do it.
Do you see this as a turning point politically?
Well, I see it as a moment anyway, that where President Trump is learning that there are limits, perhaps, even among his own supporters, that his own supporters, you know, aren't going to stick with him through everything, that they, in fact, have commitments to issues that are important to them, like immigration, criminal justice, and so forth, that Jeff Sessions has been a champion on from their point of view. President Trump is new at this politics stuff. You know, he comes from business and entertainment where, you know, a person in his position of power could just sort of do a whole lot of things he wanted to do without many constraints. And I think that the political system in Washington doesn't work that way.
So do you think that Republican senators standing up to the president and saying, we're not going to confirm this and we're going to not let you appoint someone new to replace Jeff Sessions, is that a turning point in how Republican senators are using their power?
Well, it's basically, you know, one of the first times they have decided to stand up to him in a collective way. We saw that actually just earlier this week with the advancement of this length legislation that will impose sanctions on Russia and prevent the president from lifting them without congressional, you know, consent. That's also a pretty important sign. So you take those two things together, and it does show that there's a limit to how far Republicans on the Hill are willing to go.
Well, Peter Baker, let me let you get back to work. You have a very busy job.
Well, it's certainly interesting. No question about that.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Peter Baker is the New York Times chief White House correspondent. His latest book is called Obama, The Call of History. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering from Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.